We are live.
Yay! I'm so glad we made
It's
it.
been a long time coming.
It has.
Hello and welcome to the Talking Locks with Lockitude podcast. My name is Ade Balogun. On this episode of the Chair Combos on the Talking Locks with Lockitude podcast, I have with me Kayla Williamson. Yeah, Kayla Williamson. And we do have an interesting story. But before I go ahead and tell us how I met Kayla, Kayla, would you kindly introduce yourself to us?
Hi, everyone. I'm Kayla Williamson. I'm so happy to be here. I've been one of Ade's clients slash friends for 2.5 years now.
Wow, are we 2.5 years already?
I think it's 2.5 years.
Wow.
I live in DC, originally from Nashville, Tennessee. Have lived up and down the East Coast a little bit of lots of places. And I'm currently a high school teacher.
Okay, nice to meet you, Kayla. So let's start from the beginning.
Yes.
Sometime in 2021.
Would have been 2021.
Yeah, it was early 2021. Mm-hmm. I went on a hike and Kayla stopped me on the trail and she's like, "Oh my God, your hair's so beautiful. Where do you get your hair done?" I had only been in America for like a few months. I had no idea what I was really trying to do with my life. And you know, I said, I do my hair myself and I have a whole business around it. And Kayla is like, "Okay, we exchange numbers."
I think it might have been, numbers, might have been Instagram.
Maybe Instagram.
Yeah.
Actually, maybe Instagram. And so I think the way it was numbers. Because okay. You contacted me and said, "Hey, what's your Instagram?"
Yes,
so I can look
you're
at
right.
your work. And then I sent Kayla a link to the Lockitude Instagram. And I didn't hear from Kayla again. And I was like, "Oh my God, I've ruined this. She's gone on Instagram. She's noticed that Lockitude is just in Nigeria. I did not have a US salon at the time." But that was my biggest motivation to actually start up in the US. Because my apprehension had been, where the hell am I going to get customers from? You know, I have no big connections or links in the US. And starting a business is based off of your network. So if somebody could randomly stop me in the trail or on the trail and then I lost that business, I was like, "Oh, I need to have a physical location so people can find me." So in May of 2021, I signed a lease for the space in Silver Spring. And in August, it wasn't going to be available until August of 21, which was good. It gave me some time to set up. And I believe sometime in September was when you booked
It would have been September of 21.
You booked a video consult.
It was an in-person consult.
And was it in-person?
Yes.
Was that the one we really had a great conversation?
Yes, we did. We had a really wonderful, long conversation. And then we did it. You installed the locks that day, but you had the same day.
Are you sure we didn't have a virtual one?
I'm sure because I came in person and you said, you know, "Before we do this, we need to talk through all of it." So we had maybe a 30-minute conversation about that was a consultation
what
before you started.
Okay. And then, but the more important thing is at this point, I don't think I realized that Kayla was the person I met on the trail. So at some point in our conversation, I asked, "So how did you know about me?" And she was like, "Oh, remember I met you on the trail? You know, you told me." I was like, "Oh my God, I thought I was never going to see you again." So it's been an absolute pleasure and it warms my heart that I did start your locks and that you not contacting me was actually personal. You were trying to get to that point where you were ready to start locks, but you were a very big motivation to the starting of Lockitude US because I was like, well, if someone can randomly stop me, maybe people will come. And I would say that the US has been kind to Lockitude. A lot of referrals from our Nigerian connections. And I'll say that the African American community has also been welcoming to my brand. So thank you.
I'm so glad. Yes, it makes me laugh every time I hear that side of the story because it makes a lot of sense. It didn't even cross my mind to communicate, "Oh, I'm just thinking, like, it's not personal." Or it's not personal towards you, you know, it was just that I was thinking about it. So for me, I think I have been loosely thinking about locks, probably since college. I went completely natural and stopped putting heat on my hair in 2016 when I started college. And then throughout college, getting locks had crossed my mind a couple of times, but only like, oh, I wonder. Never seriously thought about it. And then towards the end of college, I started to do braids more and more. And then I just really was thinking about how much I liked having my hair natural, but how little I liked styling it loose natural. And I was like, something's got to give. And I really think I'd like to do locks. So I had a couple of family friends who I talked to about it. But really, I think I hadn't found anyone to do my hair in any style in DC that felt like this is a person that I can connect with and that, yeah, that I want to keep going to. So back home, I had a couple of people who I had one woman who would do a silk press for me since I was really little, and then one woman who would do braids. So I just trusted, would go to them. And I kind of hadn't found that person in DC yet. So I think that was a big part of it. And then also, I see myself as a pretty indecisive person. I tend to change my mind a lot. And I felt like, well, this is a big thing and there's no going back. So I was on the fence still, but I was nudging towards being certain that I wanted locks, didn't know where I would get them done. And then I saw you on the trail and you were hiking over, and I was thinking, oh my gosh, those woman's locks are so beautiful. I'll just ask her where she goes and then I'll go there. And I was still thinking, I'll go there and I'll get more information because I wasn't ready to pull the trigger yet. And I actually don't know if I've told you this part. We passed each other twice. The first time we passed each other, I noticed and I was like, oh my gosh, that's going to be so out of the blue and jarring for someone to just approach you. I've got a mom who's very outgoing and who growing up would, especially in our town, we were one of a few Black families in our neighborhood. And so when she saw another Black woman, she was like, hey, like, I see you. She'd walk up, compliment her, ask her where she gets her hair done, ask her if she wanted to join a play group or something like that. So I had a little bit of that in me that was like, just channel. Shanara is my mom's name. It's like, channel your inner Shanara and go up. And so I went up and I said, hi. We had a really lovely exchange. Mm-hmm. And then I remember looking at your work and thinking it was great. And then I didn't think anything about
The location.
Yep. Didn't cross my mind at all. I don't even know if I noticed it. I just looked at the work and I was like, okay, filing that away. So if I do it, I'll go to her. But I didn't communicate that to you, which also in hindsight, communication is everything.
Yes, it is. But, you know, it was a good thing because if I was hesitant, I just felt like that was a potential customer that I lost because I had no physical presence in the U.S. So, it worked out.
It worked out.
Just piggybacking on what you just said, being an indecisive person. Mm-hmm. So now that you've made this decision, it's been 2.5 years?
Mm-hmm.
2.5 years or 2 years since you've had locks.
Let's see.
It was October, right?
October, yeah.
Of 21. So almost 2.5 years.
Yeah.
2.5 is kind of like about right. Do you regret this decision?
Not at all. It actually makes me think about, oh, I wonder if when I have clarity on a decision and I've thought about it a lot, turns out I'm not that indecisive and I can really go for it. I don't think I've ever regretted. There were some times in the beginning where I didn't like them all the time when they were first budding and they hadn't quite locked.
Yep.
But even then I didn't regret it. And then ever since they fully, I would say about a year in when they fully locked, I've just been in love with them.
Awesome. I'm very happy to hear that. Well, over the last couple of years, we've had fantastic conversations. You're one of my clients I really, really enjoy talking to. And I'm very happy because we've been trying to schedule this podcast since 2023.
Yes.
And now it's mid-March of 24. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I was like, okay, guess what? The studio is set up to record. And then I'm like, hey, I left the memory card at home. I was like, no, this must happen.
We made it happen.
So it was just an 8-minute drive and we got another memory card. And thank you for being patient with me. So let's see. I think one of the more interesting conversations that we've had lately was mm-hmm. with the Christian support group mm-hmm. that you were in. I found that like really fascinating. I'd never heard about anything like it before. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you tried to explain to me the context and the reason mm-hmm. why you did that. So let me start with asking the question from the beginning.
Sure.
What is a Christian support group? Or why does it exist?
Yes. So it's a cohort. The cohort's actually called Mending Souls that my internet friend Margaret came up with. And the support group is for people who have come out of church situations where they were particularly hurt within those church situations to talk about some of the themes and really to give each other encouragement as they're healing and they're moving on. And that moving on can look different for a lot of people. So all of the people in this group have started out being within a church community and being heard in that church community. Some people have found another church. Some people have found ways to reform the church they're in. Some people don't go to church at all anymore. And there's acceptance for people all across that spectrum. But a couple of the things, only at the beginning do people talk about some of the hard things that happened and sharing their stories. But then afterwards, people talk about what they want to build in their communities. So for example, we talk about what does it mean to have a sense of play? What does it mean to...
A sense of play.
A sense of play, yeah. Because one of the common themes a lot of times in people who have been in either high-control religion or close to high-control religion in their church settings is that they feel like play is bad and they feel like they always have to be doing something... Yeah, serious. Or even efficient. And I think a lot of that has ties into, especially in the United States, has ties into capitalism in terms of putting a moral imperative on being efficient and getting as much done as possible. We talk about play. We talk about rest. We talk about how to show up for your friends and be hospitable that doesn't come with kind of an extra, a lot of what we talk about is getting rid of an extra weight of like, if you do X or if you don't do X, God is displeased with you, especially in things where we look at it and say, hey, we don't think that's true. We think that's something that was culturally imposed. So how do we move forward from a place of being healthier?
Okay. If you don't mind me asking a personal question. So how did you find yourself in this group? What kind of hurt did you experience in the church mm-hmm. that made you
want to
be part of this group?
Yeah. So I went to a Christian middle school and high school. I mentioned that I grew up in Nashville. So I went to the school just outside of Nashville, about 15 minutes outside of the city in the suburbs. And my parents chose it both for its academics and because it was a Christian school. So I came from a Christian home and in my childhood, had a really pleasant childhood, a lot of happy memories and even good experiences with church growing up. But when I went to this school, it was a good experience at first, but long story short, at the end of the day, there was a lot of racial... microaggressions is the phrase we'd hear used a lot, but some of it was just outright racism. Aggression. Yeah, some of it was outright racism. There was a lot of racism that took place in the school, and in speaking up about racism, a lot of the response back was, you need to learn to forgive, you need to learn to not be offended, and they would...
Because it was masked with Christianity.
Right, right. And so the idea was that and part of being a good Christian was to learn to not take offense. But the actual, in my experience, the actual offenses were never dealt with. Yeah. And it was my experience, too, that it was a system that allowed for racism. It wasn't just a couple of moments of racism or a couple of instances of racism. So a couple of things... that when I say it, a system that allowed racism, for example, a lot of the Black students in the school played sports and would be told explicitly the only reason that you are here is because you play sports and kind of like you don't belong here outside of that. So that was just a baseline for it. But several times that students said inappropriate racist things, that teachers said inappropriate racist things, and my parents and I took it all the way up through the channels of the school. And were told that we were exaggerating or told that we needed to let things go or needed to forgive and all of that in the name of Christianity. So I think that was a big shaping thing. I think another big shaping thing is experiencing 2016 in general with Trump's election and the way that the white American church responded to that. So I am first and foremost a product of the Black American church and very ingrained in the African American church in my upbringing and what I would call in my spiritual heritage. But then I came of age during a time in the 2000s where, especially in the suburbs, a lot of the common language, and I think my family fell prey to this too, is that we were in a post-racial society. Now, my parents would have never said that they outright thought we were in a post-racial society, but I think a lot of the thought process during that time is it became very easy if you lived in a predominantly white community to blend in, to assimilate, even if you weren't trying to. So I came from a family that's a proud Black family, not thinking that being closer to whiteness is better, but there was a lot of accidental assimilation that came about during my childhood. Mm-hmm. So you get to 2016, and I was on dance teams with and friends with a lot of white folks who voted for Trump when I learned, oh, we are not on the same page about things. And a lot of that was a lot of them justified that support of Trump based on religion.
Interesting. Okay, I don't want to go too much into politics.
Yes.
but that's kind of very convoluted in itself.
Right.
Coming from a country that is predominantly Black.
Right.
And I will even say Black, because that doesn't really mean anything yes. in Africa.
Just, so Black is a social construct, yeah. Yeah.
But just kind of like all this, mostly the same, differentiated by different tribes. So you can experience discrimination in different ways, but mm-hmm. racism is on a much deeper level because you're already being judged by the color of your skin, mm-hmm. depending on how far you've come from. Mm-hmm. And I kind of can relate to what you said about accidental assimilation, mm-hmm. because you went to predominantly white institutes, mm-hmm. you grew up, you were friends with these people, mm-hmm. and but was the problem that they voted for Trump, or what was actually your issue because everybody has the freedom, you know, to support whatever candidate that they want, mm-hmm. right?
Yes, everyone has the freedom to support whatever candidate they want. I think there's two issues. I think there was the ongoing racism that I experienced way in school before 2016. The Trump piece of it all, I think, it's not just voting for him as much as justifying the things that he says, mm-hmm. specifically the way that he began his 2016 campaign of talking about Mexican immigrants in dehumanizing ways. And then
he called my country a shithole country.
Yep. And then in 2017 in Charlottesville, when there were neo-Nazi protests, and he talked about there being very good people and very fine people on both sides. I think there's definitely, I think Trump emboldened a new level of blatant white supremacy. So when I'm talking about, when I said that growing up in the 2010s, 20-teens, there was a lot of talk about us being in this post-racial society. And then I think Trump's rhetoric, in particular, really emboldened a lot of things like the neo-Nazi rallies and language about law and order, language about foreign countries in dehumanizing ways. And so I think if at the end of the day, someone says that, you know, they're based on their policy agenda, that they're going to vote Republican, that is their prerogative. But I think that to make a justification for dehumanizing rhetoric is different.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I'm happy we kind of cleared that up. I put some like, so it's not because I just felt like, well, you know, you can't be, we all can't vote for the same person, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we have different opinions, and politics is a very hot topic in my country.
Mm-hmm.
The two popular candidates for our last election were Tinubu and Obi, and depending on what side you are on,
mm-hmm.
you can be afraid to actually speak to some people. So mm-hmm. you can experience that, but sometimes what are we really talking about? What I do understand, because there were a lot of things that the media broke about Trump in his first campaign that I was like, there's no way this man's mm-hmm. going to be president. There's no way someone's going to be as brash as, you know. Anyway, let's leave Trump alone for a second.
Mm-hmm.
So let's go to school.
Mm-hmm.
You are currently a high school teacher.
Mm-hmm.
What's the age of high school? What's the range of the age?
13 to 18, 14 to 18, I guess.
Okay.
So my students, I teach sophomores and juniors, so most of my students are the youngest ones are 15, the oldest ones are 17.
So you are teaching very difficult teenagers.
Yes.
Okay, so I know people don't have eyes on the podcast, but
mm-hmm.
Kayla looks like a teenager herself. I would very well think that you were like 18, maximum going on 19.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what does it feel like to be a teacher to teenagers?
Yes. So I'm in my mid-20s. This is my first job out of college. So I've been in it. I started when I was 22. Been in it for a couple of years now. And to answer your question, was it like being a teacher to teenagers? I think that my age makes me even more aware of being on my game, because this is an environment where the students are particularly concerned about grades. They've got a lot of pressure related to college. And so because of that, I think whenever they get something less than an A, they really want to know why. And I think then when you layer on top of that, I think I've gotten more pushback than other teachers, because I think there's this baseline assumption of, you seem pretty young. Let's see if we know what you're talking about. I will say I feel like I have risen to the occasion and shown that I know my stuff, but it does make me feel like, oh, wow, I really, that motivation of I've really got to be on my game because I'm going to be, I feel that because of my age, I'm going to be under extra scrutiny.
Did the kids listen, or are they as unruly as in the movies?
Oh, they're definitely not as unruly as in the movies, because it shows up in different ways. So they will listen in when I say, like, okay, it's time to start class, or even if they're having side conversations and I need to pull the class in. So that part is not an issue. I think the things they don't show in the movies, the hidden difficulty is some of the subtle pushing the buttons and pushing boundaries of authority of, I already did that. Or are we seriously going to do this assignment? I had a student the other day, we were going through a pretty dense text. It was from Brave New World's dystopian satire. So a lot of it is a little bit confusing, which is why we're studying it. And there's a scene that a lot of characters are talking at one time, and she says, what is the author's point if not just to confuse the audience? And I was like, well, let's try that question again. If we assume that the author is not trying to confuse the audience, but she said it in all seriousness, just kind of on the attack. So I think that it's not as much rowdiness and screaming, it's more sassiness and how to navigate that. And when to let it go and realize it's just a developmental stage and it's better to be hands-off and not micromanage, and when to say, this is really a matter of respect, and as the teacher, I need to command respect. And I think walking that line moment to moment can be difficult. I don't always feel like, you know, that you made the right decision, but I feel like I get better at it over time.
Over time, yeah. All right, well done. And what made you want to be a teacher in the first place?
Yes. So it was actually far more content driven than teaching itself. I would say I love teaching now, but it started because I did speech and debate in high school. I stayed really close with my speech and debate coach. When I went to college, in the sense that I would keep up with updates on Facebook and find out how his team was doing. And in college, I started doing calls with some of his students where I would give them coaching experience. So basically, I started to, as they were getting ready for big tournaments, I would watch their speeches, give them pointers, informally started coaching. And then all of that snowballed. So from that, I started formally coaching. From that, I started coaching summer camps for other people, not just that coach. Then I got a full-time job as a speech and debate coach. And then once I started coaching, I got a job as a teacher at the school that I was
coaching. Yeah, coaching. Okay. All right. So it was a real spiral effect or a ripple effect.
Exactly.
Okay. That's pretty cool. Okay. So let's go to, where do we want to explore now? Let's see. We talk about so many interesting things, and I'm just like, where do I want to go?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's explore music.
Okay.
I know that you love the holidays.
Mm-hmm.
If we're Christmas, we will be listening to holiday music.
Yes.
You introduced me to a couple of bands. There was this band, I forget the name, but I think Jay-Z signed them up.
Oh, Infinity Song. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's you're like neo soul.
Mm-hmm.
Jazzy,
yes.
Type soul type, mm-hmm. music. So for someone who is relatively young compared to, mm-hmm. me, where did you acquire this taste in music?
Started with my parents. So my parents love a lot of 80s R&B. So they introduced me at a young age to Luther Vandross, to Anita Baker, Sade. That was pretty much the soundtrack.
You know Sade's Nigerian?
No.
She is. Sade Adu. Yes. Okay.
I did not. That's so fun. So we had a lot of that music was playing when I was younger. And then what else? Maxwell, a lot of Alicia Keys. I think those were more, as they were coming out, we would listen to them. And then as I developed my own style, I really enjoy songwriting, probably because I enjoy writing itself. So I started to value writing that, or music that focused on the lyrics and less on that hook in those catchy songs. So a lot of those early artists that I just mentioned, I still absolutely love and inform my taste. But I think when I started to develop my own music taste, it was probably pretty late. It was probably around the end of high school and the beginning of college. And I found a lot of people on YouTube. I wonder how much of that was me coming into my own and how much of that was
the influence of AI.
Exactly. Even the availability of music on that platform, because even though I didn't grow up that long ago, we still had to buy all of our music individually on iTunes, as opposed to streaming came around about when I was finishing up high school. So that led me to a lot of exploration. And so now I'm, my wheelhouse is definitely in neo-soul, singer-songwriter. But I just love music.
Okay. There are a few things that pops to my mind when we're talking about music.
Mm-hmm.
I want to touch on dating. Mm-hmm. And then I'll go back to race for a bit.
Okay.
So you are in your mid-20s, and this is the time people usually meet their forever person. Mm-hmm. When I was in my mid-20s, social media was at least not as advanced as it is today. Mm-hmm. It was easier to meet people the way we met people back in the day before mm-hmm. social media. And so, like, right now, what is the dating scene like, especially, like, in this area in the DMV? Mm-hmm. At the apps, like, do you just look to the apps to just see who's put themselves out there? Or is there still avenues where people actually set up things to meet people?
Yes. Okay, so one of my favorite things to look into recently has been in-person dating that's been facilitated. So similar to speed dating, but where on social media they're letting you know that it's going on. And so these groups, there's
social media speed dating?
Well, they tell you on social media that's happening, and then it happens in real life. So there's one called We Met in Real Life. and then there's another one that the name is escaping me right now. But the We Met in Real Life is actually New York-based, but they have a couple of DC pop-ups. And then I'm completely blanking on the other one that's DC-based. But those are events I've only been able to go to one. They're very difficult to get into as a woman because they keep the numbers of...
count them. Mm-hmm.
Well, they keep the numbers of men and women even. So they make sure that it's like, if for this event, if there's going to be 25 women, there's going to be 25 men there.
So at every point in time, everybody has someone they're talking to?
Right. But I actually, as an attendee, appreciate that because those types of things tend to be far more, there tends to be far more female interest. So if you're a woman looking for a man, it's slim pickings. So it helps that they're evening out that number in a sense, but then it also means it's really difficult to get a ticket. So that's an avenue I know of. I mean, people still go, you know, out to bars and ask people out while they're out and about, at bars. And I have been approached at live events. I've approached people at live events before at being out and about. But I definitely think, those two things aside, the apps are the main ways that I'm meeting people, that I know that a lot of my friends are meeting people.
Okay, and does it feel awkward in any way, or is just a thing of the time? That's how people meet.
Oh, I think it is awkward. I actually think the faster you can get in person, the less awkward it is. One of the things that's awkward for me is knowing how to volley a text conversation with someone who I don't already know. I actually already have a difficult time keeping up with my friends and family over text. But it's far easier with someone who you already know and you can pull on those experiences. And when I text my friends, I'm asking them, oh, how did that thing go at work? And I, you know, there's that, you're not just texting about nothing. There's that bank of shared experience. So texting a stranger feels like a fish out of water to me. I really, really struggle with that component. So I do try, if I feel like there's mutual interest and this person seems nice, I try and get in person as soon as possible.
As soon as possible. Okay. That's interesting. Okay. Well, it's good to know. I never knew that there were like this, what did you call the other one? We met in real life. Mm-hmm. I didn't know there was stuff like that around. So mm-hmm. I know I've seen a few things on social media mm-hmm. on like maybe events that mm-hmm. people plan. So there's like an event itself or like mm-hmm. an activity. And then, you know, it's for single people type mm-hmm. thing. But yeah, it's a new world. And does AI creeping into the school system? Are you mm-hmm. finding people doing their assignment? Can you even tell?
So if someone that's a good question. Yeah. I mean, we have found people. We don't know if we found everyone because, you know, we wouldn't know. But I actually heard from a colleague recently who just went to a conference about AI who said that the data right now is not showing that AI is helping people cheat more. It's just the main way that people are cheating now. And so, in other words, It's not turning non-cheaters into cheaters. It's just the method of choice for people who would be cheating anyways. It's
turning cheaters into real cheaters.
Right. It's just making people more savvy at being cheaters, which was really fascinating. And he actually brought up some interesting statistics about how, you know, the rates of plagiarism have been pretty steady recently. And so what we're doing in the classroom is trying to make it harder and harder for it to not be your own work, as well as to talk about, you know, integrity issues and all of that. But ultimately, we're not at this moment, in his words, we're not fighting a kind of unprecedented, we are fighting an unprecedented battle with AI, but it's not increasing the number of students who'd say, okay, I'm going to go ahead and cheat. I think that could change really quickly. I think that sounds comforting right now, but we are just at the tip of what this thing could be. And it's funny, I mentioned just a minute ago that in school we're studying dystopia. When we study dystopia, one of the features of it is that when you go beyond the bounds of science into uncharted waters, there's going to be unprecedented consequences. And so you can make all of the adjustments you want to try and stave off the consequences you can see, but there's going to be other consequences that you can't see.
Okay. But what about the advantages of AI in the school system? As a teacher yourself, is there space for you to actually use AI to be able to get your work done? And if you can use it, do you use it? Is the first question. And if you can use it, how's that different from you being the one cheating?
Yeah, that's something that we talk about often, about when is it okay and when is it not okay. I found that, so I do use it, and I'll go into the scenarios in which I use it. But I found that in scenarios where I feel like it would be cheating are scenarios in which you can't really do your job well and use AI. So, for example, I have to write prompts for essays on a pretty regular basis. I write comments on students' grade reports that are pretty lengthy, and I give feedback to their essays. So I can go through each of those and just point out some of the ways in which if I were to use AI, it would be horrible. Like I couldn't pass it off as my own in that particular instance because of the goal of what I'm trying to accomplish. So with writing prompts for students, we are not using a textbook. So we're using a gathering of several primary sources and several academic journals. And so when I set out to say something about, for instance, to write about the effect of the Industrial Revolution, I couldn't just plug in that time period because there's going to be two authors that from completely different time periods that have written about the Industrial Revolution that we've read in class.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just no way to turn that into an AI prompt. So that's the kind of work that I'm doing, you know, on my own, that it comes from my brain to the paper, similar with the comments that I write on grade reports. And then the feedback that I give to them is so interwoven with their own writing that it's not like a chunk of feedback that I'm giving to them. It's responses to their writing within. So that I do myself.
Did they submit their work electronically?
Yes.
And so what's stopping you from loading their work into a prompt and saying, hey, grade this writing?
Oh, I could do it, but it would be horrible. And I would know it, and they would know it, my supervisor would know it. Maybe those people wouldn't all know that it was done with AI, but they would know that's horrible.
Have you tried?
I have not tried. But I do know that I, in grading it, I mean, so I'm looking for their thesis to be argumentative, and I'm looking for their evidence to connect to their thesis are the main things I'm looking for.
Ask ChatGPT, hey, look for the arguments, look for this, look for that in this body of work.
I don't think so, because I feel that ChatGPT, like what it can do, even though, and this is interesting because we don't know where it's going, but right now, what it can do is it can explain back to you, it can synthesize existing information, but it can't actually generate, even though we call it generative AI, it can't actually generate. So it can't, like, it's not sentient enough to understand, like, this is the argument and this is the...
to disagree.
You don't think so?
Yeah, because I know I prompted ChatGPT to say, hey, can you write a paragraph that's a shout out to a team of people who contributed to the holiday party, which went amazing. Write a shout out to the holiday party team. And it generated content based off of that prompt that I was able to use about 90% of the content. It was a whole paragraph. I didn't have to sit down and think about it. It was heartwarming, heartfelt. It seemed like somebody put some time behind it. And I was like, okay, this works for me. So maybe you should try, just out of curiosity.
Yeah, maybe I will. So, but I do think, I think that's different than what I, because I have used AI in other ways before. So I have used it for prompts for a speech and debate. And so different than with history class when I'm asking them to, you know, synthesize all this information. In speech and debate, when I want to say, give me a prompt for fourth graders about believing in themselves. Right? And then it'll say, tell me about tell me about a time that you had to overcome some obstacle, because that's actually a pretty, I teach middle school speech and debate in the afternoons, and a really monotonous part of my job is coming up with a new prompt every day to get them talking. And it just, it would come into my brain midday when I was in the middle of something else, and
you would lose it.
Yeah. And it just also, it didn't matter that I was the one who was thinking of it. Because if at the end of the day, the goal is to get them to stand up straight and to project their voice, it didn't matter if the prompt came from me or if the prompt came from ChatGPT. I felt like with that, I've seen what you're saying, that it gives a lot of words. The words make sense. Like it feels thoughtful. I just don't know the reacting to the grading part. I don't know. I mean, I haven't tried it, so yeah. I can't say for certain.
For you to try. So the next time you come and get your head done, sorry about that.
Oh, you're good.
The next time you come and get your head done, I will be asking you. How did it go? Did you try it out? Because sometimes when I put in that prompt for that holiday party shout out, I know I specified that she gave me a paragraph, but I put in only a few words. I said it was a shout out to the holiday party team. I don't even think I even said what they did. And the text was pretty good. It was almost like ChatGPT was at that holiday party. So that was good. So it'll be interesting, because sometimes we limit ourselves to what can this do for us and what can't it do for us. But do you feel like AI is going to come and take our jobs, or will it create more jobs? Are we in trouble? Do you think it's the future, or do you think it's the beginning of our doom?
I am not hopeful about it. I've talked to friends who are, and I've seen ebb and flow of people say, you know, well, if we learn to work with it, if we learn to harness it for good, I get that. But I'm just thinking about what's happened with social media platforms and even over the past 10 years, how much algorithms have changed to increase profit, to keep us addicted to social media, how addicting it is for teenagers. I think something that had a lot of benefits, that still has a lot of benefits. If you think about things like how you've grown your business, if you think about things like how I met that support group I was talking about, like there's so many reasons that social media can be a positive thing. But when I think about the upshot of screen addiction and like the loss of attention span and the loss of ability to connect with one another face to face, I think that could have been avoidable. We could have done social media in a different way, but it was in the interest of making money for the,
so we did it the way we did.
For, you know, Facebook. So we did it the way that we did it. And so I just can't see a way with AI. Like, yes, it can certainly be used for good. And with social media, it's still being used for good to this day, But I don't think there's going to be enough restraints on the negative outcomes, because I think someone's going to profit over the negative outcomes.
Yeah. And how much good negates the bad, right?
Or right.
The evil. It's complex. The complex world that we live in. I feel like I'm usually very, you know, ready to debate and look at issues and try and discuss them and mm-hmm. look at the opposite side and the flip side.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm battling with addiction to my cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I deceive myself constantly that I have to be on Instagram because I run a business
mm-hmm.
and it helps to get customers.
Mm-hmm.
But how do I explain the 3 to 6 hours I spend on my mm-hmm. phone without posting one thing for 7 weeks helping my business? You know, and how is all of the information that I'm absorbing even remotely in any way making me efficient or effective mm-hmm. in my life? So every now and again, maybe you find something mm-hmm. that comes to light, but yeah, it's a struggle.
Mm-hmm.
It's a struggle. I don't know the answers to these questions.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't know the answers to these questions. Okay, so let's move on to talking about someone who went to a predominantly white institute and having accidental assimilation. Yep. And growing up in a like predominantly white area.
Mm-hmm.
So do you, and you did say that your family was ingrained in the Black
mm-hmm.
church.
Yes.
And you are Black and proud.
Yes.
But do you feel any different from somebody who grew up in a more Black neighborhood?
Yes. I think both things are true.
Okay, so can you just tell me about that experience? So when you are around people who grew up in predominantly Black areas, do mm-hmm. you feel Black enough?
Mm.
Or are there any times you feel like, you know, I'm not Black enough mm-hmm. or my Blackness is not the same thing as this other Black? And I'll say something because it kind of struck me very odd. I came to America right around COVID period, mm-hmm. George Floyd had happened,
mm-hmm.
and I was speaking to an African woman who has 3 sons. And I was empathizing with what had happened to George Floyd and how unimaginative it mm-hmm. was that could even be happening to a human being in 2020.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, George Floyd doesn't represent us.
Mm.
My son is not in George Floyd. I was very new in the country at the time, but I was like, that doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
In the way the media portrays all of these things, your son is Black
mm-hmm.
and he could very well be George Floyd.
Mm-hmm.
But she was like, no, maybe George Floyd engaged in narcotics or some other drug or smoked weed, and that's not her mm-hmm. son, and that's mm-hmm. not a representative of her son.
Mm-hmm.
And that cannot possibly or potentially happen to her son. I feel like that was blindsided. But are there different levels of Blackness
mm.
in this country? And are there any times where you felt like you're too Black? Or because you've told us about how you've experienced racism in school and in mm-hmm. church and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's happening because of the color of your skin.
Mm-hmm.
And then you also feel different to the mm-hmm. people who look exactly like you.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you navigate?
Yes. Oh, that's a good question. Okay, so there's a couple of layers to that. So in short, to answer one of the questions that you asked, do I ever struggle with not feeling Black enough? Yes, I do. I think that has lessened the older I've gotten. Because I think the older I've gotten, the more sure of myself I've become. And also the more that I've realized what I want in friendship. And so, and I've realized that what I want in friendship is possible. So what I mean by that is I think that whenever you see a group of people that you feel like you don't belong to as a group, it can be very intimidating. So when I was in white spaces, longing to be in spaces that had more Black people, thinking my assumption was all of the Black people in this predominantly Black spaces are so self-assured, don't have the same insecurities that I have, know that they belong. And I think that the more that I've grown up and I've gotten to, in coming to the DMV, which has pockets of it that are predominantly Black, and that I've really sought out friendships with Black folks, the more I've seen people as individuals and realized Like, oh, we've all got our stuff. We've all got our issues. We've all got our insecurities. I'm not on an island of not belonging on my own little planet. We're just all trying to make it in the world. And so when that's part of it. And then I think the other thing is that I've really come to value friends that don't make me feel less than, and to not have time and energy for friendships that I have to chase. So if I'm around other Black folks where I do feel like I've got to prove myself, and I feel like my accent is a liability because I think my accent really gives away that I'm from Nashville. If I feel like I can't belong because of that, or because, you know, I grew up in a predominantly white environment, then I'm aware that, like, I'm not going to hustle for my worthiness. But what I've found is that's not been my experience all that often. I've found plenty of wonderful Black friends who accept me as I am, with all of my quirks, with all of my obsessions with different TV shows, with my
accidental assimilation.
My accidental assimilation. And so I think moving from, oh, there's this group of people who belongs more than you and you're going to feel not good enough, to getting up close and being like, there's some people in this group who are great friends. There's some people in this group who are going to judge you, and being as individuals, making that decision of who I'm going to be friends with, has been really helpful and freeing, and has gotten me to a point where I think I don't struggle as much anymore with feeling like I'm not quote unquote Black enough. So I think that's one part. I think you touched on something else about how many different experiences there can be of being Black in this country. And so I can only speak for myself, for my family has been here for a very long time, since American chattel slavery. And I think that experience a lot of times is in the background of the ways that Americans, Black Americans who have immigrated from different countries in Africa, and Black Americans who are African American, experience being in America really differently.
Yeah. I completely agree. A lot of nuance sometimes mm-hmm. on your Blackness is kind of seen for granted.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, there have been some experiences that I've been like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
And I've had experiences where I'm like, was this person being a racist? Mm-hmm. But that's because all my life, that's not something I was confronted with. Mm-hmm. So
yeah.
Half the time, it's lost on me. I'm like, oh, okay, you're just being... Because individuals are individuals, and you have all sorts of individuals around the entire world.
Mm-hmm.
So regardless of where you come from, you're going to find somebody who is going to be nasty towards you for whatever reason, because they think you're too short, because they think you're too tall, or you're too fat, or you're too skinny. And sometimes race is not the only avenue to experience some foolishness.
Yes.
Yeah.
I definitely think it's not the only avenue, but I think it's such a meaningful avenue.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting, too, that when you're talking about different experiences of politics in your country, I feel like things that seem to me to be not just be political, but seem to be racial in nature, can seem like someone else to be more political and less racial.
Yep.
So I think that is
so
too.
Well, to be fair to the other side of things, even though we do not have a complexity of race, but tribe is a big thing.
Mm-hmm.
And we can oftentimes tell ourselves apart from how we look as well, based off of your tribe.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you have different reasons, people have different supporters. And I feel like I've felt into that bucket sometimes where I'm like, I don't know who to vote for. This person is from my tribe.
Mm-hmm.
Why not?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of tribal discrimination that can happen when you are in parts of the country. And it could happen vice versa. If you are in an area which is one tribe, you can be discriminated mm-hmm. against by people from the other tribe and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
So we've seen a lot of that mirrored. But yes, I think race is a different complexity on it. With the history that we have of slavery, colonialism,
mm-hmm.
it's just a very complex topic and situation.
Mm-hmm.
So one of these days, I'm going to sit with myself and actually gather my thoughts about how I really feel about race. Mm-hmm. Because I do have a day job, and at my day job, sometimes things happen and I'm like, was this a racial sentiment or was this person just being stupid?
Mm-hmm.
And because I don't want to be bound or limit myself or become in a place whereby you are thinking it's because of how you are. I've never mm-hmm. had to face that before. So it's difficult for me to try and put myself in that point. So I've chosen mm-hmm. most times to be like, you know what? This person is just someone you have to deal with mm-hmm. because I've dealt with people in similar fashion.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm choosing intentionally not to add the complexity of race to it, but sometimes it's obvious.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
I think that with that makes a lot of sense to kind of give yourself the breathing room to just assume best intentions and be like, it's going to make it easier for my life right now if I just assume best intentions. And I also think, though, I didn't quite hear you use this word, but I kind of implied in what you just said, so you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I heard you say that you don't want to kind of jump to conclusions that it's about race. And I think in there, there's also this not wanting to take on a victim mentality, wanting to be responsible for what you can be responsible for and kind of control what's yours to control. Is that fair?
Yes, very okay. fair.
So I think that's definitely a good way to go through life. But I also wonder, in my experience, I feel like as Black people in this country, we get accused of having a victim mentality when it's actually
racism.
Yes. When it's racism or when it's the point is to say, like, this is what I saw. Like, it happened in a coded way. It happened in a veiled way, but this is the dynamic at play. There's a white supremacist dynamic to it. And all I'm doing is shining a flashlight on it and bringing it into the light. And I think part of what builds I think the fruit of a victim mentality is if you say, because of this hardship, I can't get ahead, right? And you stay stuck in that. But when I see people hustling and working hard, especially like the way that you approach all of your work, when I see people doing their best with what's within their control and they're not asking for anything, they're just saying, this is my experience. I think that to me is normally a sign that, like, you're doing the right thing, that you're not being a victim. Because I think being a victim is to say, I can't get ahead and I'm going to
wallow.
Yeah, as opposed to when you're taking accountability for how you're going to do the best you can. And as you're doing it, you're speaking up for yourself. And I think sometimes we get cut off from speaking up for ourselves because we don't want to be seen as playing the victim. That I don't know. I just think it's sometimes an added burden.
Okay. Oh, wow. We have been talking for about 58 minutes now. And I've really enjoyed this conversation because I've been speaking with all of my heart, my mind, and all of that. Yep. Yes. Okay. I could call you back. I think I have your number on the system. All right. Thank you. Yeah. Okay, well, that's our next client already waiting at the door. But yes, where were we?
You said in this conversation you've gotten to engage heart, mind.
Yes, yes. And I have been using not just my heart, mind, but my hands to gesticulate that I forgot to put my hand in your hair. This was the risk I was trying to avoid by doing hair and having the...
Oh.
But it's funny because it's natural. These are the conversations that we have mm-hmm, when mm-hmm. we speak. So, yeah, that complexity is it's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, it's spring of 2024 that we're having this conversation. You did say that you were going to go up to New York
at yes.
the end part of the week?
I'm headed to New York at the end of the week.
Do you have any big plans while you're over there?
I do. I'm going to stand in line for some Broadway tickets. So I'll see if we get some. And then I'm going
to... standing in line is usually cheaper than buying them online.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So you can get them like under $50 for sure. You just kind of wait to see who doesn't come get their standby tickets.
Is it ever sold out?
Sometimes. Well, the really popular shows will be like Hamilton will be sold out. Wicked will be sold out. But something that's newer and smaller, you'll probably be able to get tickets for.
Okay. So Broadway?
Yes. So going to Broadway and then...
Have you ever been to New York?
I have. I've been a couple of times with the friends that I'm going to see live up there, our friends from college that live up there. So I've seen them a couple of times. And then I went once with my family a couple of years ago. So
okay.
Yeah.
So you've done the touristy stuff.
Yes. Done the touristy
bridge.
Stuff. Yes. I've done all of the things, seen all the sights. So this time I'm going to show and then going to eat a lot of good food. I like how they have so many great restaurants there. So.
Okay, sounds like it's going to be fun.
Yes.
I feel like there's a lot I've left out. I feel like I'm going to end this recording and then I'm going to remember.
We'll have to come back another time.
All the things that I want to talk about. But I think it's been a pleasure so far. We've touched on quite a number of things. AI, being a teacher, mm-hmm. Race dynamics, growing up around predominantly white people. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, I don't know if that term is right.
Yeah.
First, you're actually the first person that told me, so I went to a PWI and I was like, what's that?
Have you heard it a lot since then?
Yes.
Yeah.
And now I'm not lost. There's even another one. So there's PWI and there's PWC.
Yeah, PWC. Yeah.
PWC and then the HBU. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, you know, I'm American now.
Yes, you get all the things.
Well, it's always a pleasure to speak to you, Kayla. Thank you so much for having this conversation.
Always
with
so
me.
Lovely. Thank you.
For those of you listening out there, you can find the podcast. If you're listening, it means you already found the podcast, but you can listen to more episodes. We should be everywhere you find your podcast. It's been a pleasure as always, and keep it locked with a locket. Keep it locked with an attitude at Lockitude. Yeah. And I need to finish Kayla's hair so that we can get a 6 o'clock appointment in. Bye now. Yeah.
Bye.